we don't need to demonize technology. We can engage in it with them, have conversations with them, and also give them some really important time to rest.
With the police department, it's a great way for us to engage with the youth. It's really changed the way we can get information out.
This is part of our duty in protecting students, often from themselves, but also teaching them how to use these tools in a positive manner versus a negative one.
Social media is one of the most powerful new tools of our time. It gives us the power to stay in touch with family and friends or to meet new people without moving or even saying anything out loud. But what does that shift in perspective mean for our mental health? Over the next 4 episodes of Living Online, we'll be having conversations about social media and how it can impact mental health, especially for young adults and children who have never known a world without it. In today's episode, we'll talk about impacts of actions taken online that can affect life offline. Today, I'm joined by Cottage Grove Police Chief Pete Kerner.
Well, thanks for having me.
Social media and mental health expert Aaron Walsh.
Thanks for having me.
And Park High School Assistant Principal Sarah Scullin-Stokes.
Hello.
Thanks for being here today. So in the first episode, we talked a lot about some of the benefits of social media and some of the positive things that we've seen. So to start off, let's just briefly touch on that a little bit before moving into some of, you know, the challenges of social media. So Aaron, maybe what are some of the benefits of that you've seen from social media?
Yeah, I'm so glad we had an episode where we got to kind of spend a lot more time on that than we will today, because of course there are so many benefits. Young people are sort of extending and deepening friendships that they have offline into online spaces, right? Maybe they don't have, logistically can't see each other, but sort of developing a depth of relationship just over time, where especially those relationships that sort of bridge real life or online and offline spaces. They're getting support from each other, whether it's around the daily stressors or whether it's around significant mental health concerns, where they're either getting support from professionals or getting support from their peers. And they're learning, right? They're doing what we want them to do. They're being curious. They're engaged in the world. They're participating in conversations. So there's a lot that we can get excited about as we think about the benefits of growing up digital.
Yeah, I agree with Aaron. Instructionally, there's a lot of benefit to social media. So there's resources at students' fingertips. There's different ways to engage students in their instruction in school. Of course, we need to help set boundaries and things, but there's some real benefits as long as it's used appropriately.
Yeah, with the police department, it's a great way for us to engage with the youth. It's really changed the way we can get information out, whether it's on Facebook or some of the other Instagram, Twitter. It's a really good tool.
Awesome. Thank you. So with some of those positive things, you know, we spoke a lot about those. So now as we look at some of the challenges of social media and, you know, as this episode talks about, you know, when things online go offline. So what are some of the real life risks of online activities for teens that we're facing today?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think about this question about the positives and the negatives, researcher Dana Boyd talks about that young people's lives today online are more permanent, they're more spreadable, they're more searchable than ever before. So, you know, if that means it can sort of amplify the positives, it also means it can really sort of magnify and amplify some of the challenges and the risks as well. So, you know, there's parents and folks that are listening, anyone listening to this podcast is probably well aware of some of the challenges, right? The power struggles that happen at home around time. And then sort of what it means when we're posting things that maybe, you know, a young person might post something when they're angry or when they're feeling isolated or when they're trying to, you know, maybe they're feeling great because they're making other kids laugh, but then they forget that there's another human being, right, that's sort of experiencing the emotional impact of that. So when I work with parents across the country, you know, one of the things that everyone's worried about is that strangers are approaching their kids online. And certainly, I mean, here we have an officer in the room. Certainly we want to be doing that baseline safety talk. But what's also true in terms of the data is that young people are much more likely to do damage to each other. That's sort of some of the cruelty, some of the harassment, some of the toxicity that can start to boil and really get magnified and spread very quickly in a sort of hyper-visible, hyper-spreadable social media space, that this kind of interpersonal exchanges, whether it's bullying and we can identify it as such, or what I think of more as sort of a culture of cruelty online, that can range from everything from repeated bullying behaviors over time to, you know, all caps messages that somebody misinterprets and then it blows up in the hallways the next day. So, you know, young people have always tried to figure out ways to navigate conflict, and it's unfortunately when it's online, it's, you know, we're losing a lot of some of the facial expressions, a lot of the things that will help us navigate the complex messiness of human relationships successfully. So things can get very amplified very quickly and do a lot of damage very quickly. And so I think having real conversations about that early and often becomes really, really important. And then we're not just talking about bullying, but we're talking about the whole range of behaviors that can contribute to hurt feelings and feelings of not feeling safe. Whether online and then, of course, offline as well. So just the last point, and I'm curious to hear what other panelists are seeing and hearing from students, but what we see in the data, at least, is that for the most part, the things that are playing out online are also happening offline, for the most part. So it might be bigger, you might be more cruel or more mean in online spaces, but for the most part, if two kids are fighting online, they're likely experiencing some of those same dynamics in the hallways or on the field. That's not all the time, but it's important for us to know that it's not just a tech issue. It's also it's a human issue. It's a social emotional issue. So we have to address the tech part, but we also have to address, you know, what does kindness look like? What does empathy look like in both online and offline spaces?
Wow, drop the mic. I think you nailed it, Erin. I would just add to your description, the difficulty I see is just the lack of boundaries. And you kind of inferred that, but there is no time boundaries. It's not like old school bullying where it tends to stop at the end of the school day. Students are on their phones until 2 a.m. sometimes, depending on their situation. There's no boundaries as far as the publicity. Students might feel that they're safe putting something out on Snapchat, but of course we all know there's ways to get around that and taking a second device and taking a screenshot. So it's really the lack of boundaries, and I really feel for students who are growing up in this age, and I've had many discussions with my colleagues in that we're so grateful we did not grow up with social media, because mm-hmm. it's the most poisonous tool for someone who is just at the developmental stage where impulse control is a challenge. Because you have a thought, you have a strong emotion, and in a couple keystrokes, you have just displayed that for all to see, and it's a mostly permanent record and really hard to recover from. So the lack of boundaries, again, is a difficult piece for students from what I see.
And I love how you brought up these students are the technology, what they're dealing with, so much different. You used the term old school bullying. And that's what we're really struggling with is how quickly things can spread. The school and the police department, we work together really well. The challenge is it might happen at 8 o'clock at night. The parents call the police department. We get involved in it. And by morning, that has spread so far before the first bell even rings that things have gone viral. It's gotten out of control. So, and everyone, the parents, you know, this isn't something that they grew up with. And law enforcement, we didn't grow up with it. So a lot of times these kids the students have a kind of a leg up. They're always finding the new app. They're finding how to be anonymous. And you know, so it's a huge challenge. But, you know, we'll continue to improve things and move forward.
Can you speak a little bit more on that partnership between, you know, the school and just the police department?
Yeah, Cottage Grove, and I know Woodbury also has school resource officers, and their role continues to change. I was the school resource officer back in 98, and kids didn't have cell phones. At the tail end, they started getting pagers, so we started dealing with some of that. So our school resource officers really are kind of the pulse of the school, and they work hand-in-hand with school administrators, with assistant principals and principals. So it definitely is it's a team effort, and we have other resources that we can bring too, and it is a good collaboration.
And can you speak to, so with the school resource officers, maybe what are some of the most common issues that they're seeing related to the internet and social media?
I've had a lot of conversations with our school resource officers, and right away they did talk about a lot of the positives. You know, they talked about, you know, the social networking aspect, the kids like Instagram, they use Snapchat and some of those, but a lot of it comes, there's some are still pretty naive and they don't understand some of these other apps that they're meeting with people. I think, you know, they talked about now they're having Monkey, they're having House Party, and there's, I think with any application, there's, I think it's, the thought is for something good, you know, to meet other kids. I think some of the kids that are more introverted, it's a good way to meet people. But then there's the other group out there that will exploit these other students, and it, you know, a little naive, and they don't know that some of the risks and the behaviors.
Awesome. Sarah, I think you can build upon that too, yeah, as you partner with our school resource officers, and you mm-hmm. see a lot of issues every day, I'm mm-hmm. sure, with social media and our students. If you don't want to expand on some of those common online scenarios.
Sure. So it's not uncommon for me to enter the school building at 7:30 in the morning and have our school resource officer waiting for me to share what happened overnight and which students we need to intervene with right away. What the police did overnight as far as showing up at doors and trying to squash something. You know, I've had collaboration with SROs in other buildings as well when something gets big. So the phrase kind of smaller world and bigger problems sticks out in my mind as far as the world is extremely small. And if a bullying or harassment or conflict situation erupts, it is not uncommon for family members or cousins or friends from other buildings to get involved, other schools. And there's been a number of situations where it's not only Cottage Grove PD I'm collaborating with, but it might be Forest Lake, it might be St. Paul. And that's because, again, everything is so public. And when something is put out there, it can really spread like wildfire. But I do appreciate the collaboration we do have in order to try to squash these things. And I feel really proud of the work we do. Although, honestly, I do regret the amount of time that we have to spend on it. But I've come to accept that. And I've come to learn that this is now a part of the job. This is part of our duty in protecting students, often from themselves, but also teaching them how to use these tools in a positive manner versus a negative one. And to, you know, lean in on difficult situations and make them a learning experience so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, as I listen to the two of you talk, it's so fun to be in the room with school, you know, police or law enforcement, and then I sort of have the parent hat on, because it really is, that's the partnership that's essential. I mean, so much of the heavy lifting happens at home, of course, because those conversations about talking early and talking often and not putting our head in the sand, but really being sort of engaged and involved and making sure that we are having those conversations, not just about, you know, what are the signs and what should I be on the lookout to see if my student is maybe, or my child is being targeted, a target of bullying behaviors, acknowledging that your child might try out being mean. Like, a lot of parents are worried that their kid is going to be the target, but that we have to be open to thinking about ways that our kids just fall into some things that they aren't sure how to get out of, and things get really big really fast. And then that idea that things spread really quickly, making sure that we're talking to our kids about, it's not inevitable that it spreads like wildfire, that everyone has a powerful role as an audience member, right?
Absolutely.
So I think sometimes we focus so much on the child, or the, you know, the student who's exhibiting bullying behaviors, and then the target, that we forget that it's not inevitable that something blows up if, you know, having those conversations about what do you do if you see this? You know, how do you make sure that you're not, you know, that you're empathizing with the target, that you're not forwarding things on, that you're not sort of providing this sort of affirmation or, oh, did you see this, and send it to 30 people. Even if you're sending it along, your kid sending it along is like, I can't believe this happened. It's still just magnifying the problem. Mm-hmm. So for, you know, there's way more of our kids are part of the audience than they are actually in the dynamic. And that's a powerful role. So, you know, how do we start those conversations early and often and be really specific about what does it look like? What do you actually do when you see this? If you see a sexually inappropriate photo, if you see someone being mean to someone else, you know, what does it mean to take a deep breath and, you know, don't forward it on, show it to an adult? I mean, those are the kinds of things that if we wait to have those conversations till our kids are 16 or until something's blown up, we've missed an opportunity.
That is such an important point, being a an upstander versus a bystander is the lingo we use in school. But I'll just say a number of my coaching conversations with students is around that. So liking something or reposting something or whatever verbs I'm not up on yet is being a part of the problem. Right. If it's something mean, if it's something negative. And so that is something I'm seeing students learn. I mean, they're receptive to that. Once you have that conversation, typically, you know, they don't make that mistake again. But I really appreciate your point of talk early and talk often. And we're trying to do that as a school system. But we do really need parents' help in that because obviously parents are who students look up to the most. And if they're hearing it from both school and from home, I know that we can put a dent and a significant dent in some of the negativity that we see online.
Especially that you know, I, at least in my experience, and I'm sure you working with students too, most students at this point in, you know, can say that they understand. So if you say like something online is permanent, like most students aren't like, what? I had no idea. Mm-hmm. Most of them are like, yeah, I've been hearing that since I was in kindergarten, right? That often it's not about they don't, you know, it's not like I don't understand. It's habit and it's impulse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So really at home, one of the things we can do is we're building a set of, it's not just saying here's the risk cognitively, that it's about building healthy habits. And those only happen over time when we learn from our mini mistakes, where we create sort of these, you know, what we do in our family is that before we send a text, we take a deep breath. Mm-hmm. And we model that when you're sending a text in kindergarten to grandma. So this idea that, you know, we're just building habits around humanizing the internet from a very young age. So listeners who have kindergartners and first graders are part of this conversation as well, that your child is likely still interacting in both online and offline spaces. But I love that, you know, being a powerful upstander from a very young age becomes really important.
Absolutely.
That is a huge key with that age. Don't wait until they're 16. Yes, yeah. I mean, we have this in the middle school. We have in the elementary schools where they're using that technology. So start having those conversations when they're much younger. Yeah. I'm not saying if you wait until you're 16, it's too late. But, you know, start having those conversations because we keep seeing it at a younger and younger age. But always, I love when you bring up, take a deep breath before you send that text. Same thing that adults do at work. Look at your email, read it.
Don't reply all.
Yes. You know, take your time and think about what your actions mean. It's the same for the teens and younger ones too.
Yeah.
So I think about as a parent, then, you know, we talked a lot. Those are some really great strategies and resources and tips for our parents that are listening. When something happens, when should a parent step in? You know, what about the resources that parents could use to monitor, control, or as far as just when do they step in when something does happen to their child? With, you know, we see it every day in schools. A lot of students are affected by it. So I guess at what point as a parent then, you know, when do you intervene?
Yeah, and I can talk a little bit. There's two parts to that question, and I'd love to hear from you two and like sort of what's the dream scenario from the school side. You know, I think in terms of monitoring and control, certainly I think part of interacting in online spaces is that we see that if parents can be kind of talking early and often and presenting this idea, right, that trust isn't just something you just write a blank check and it's like, oh, I trust you. And if I ever look, then it means I don't trust you. Like you yes. earn trust over time. You earn and then you repair when there's been an incident. And so the goal with monitoring isn't to catch your kids being bad, but it's to encourage positive behavior and to encourage communication. So I always say, you know, don't install and then catch them 3 months later and be like, well, here are the 50 things I saw you doing. When we tend to be sort of a catch or catching their poor behavior, they tend to go to the darker corners of the internet. So, you know, tell them part of having a device, part of being on our family computer, part of, you know, whatever online devices you have is that we're going to have parental controls. When they're little, that might mean you're really involved. You know, with your younger kids and the younger students in this district, we really can still be thinking about creating a very safe playground. We're creating, you know, safe search engines and using your, using your media specialist as a resource. I'm sure there's all kinds of things through the district that we know are designed for our younger students in mind. And then as they get older, that we're still saying, you know, they're part of having a device is that we're going to be kind of just coming in and out. I don't have time, nor do I care to read every single text. I'm not interested in spying on you and micromanaging every word that you use with your friends. I think we do have to pick our battles. But I think that the idea that doesn't mean that I'm just going to put my head in the sand, cross my fingers and hope everything turns out okay. That just like when we, you know, have, we want our kids to invite their friends to our house so we can walk through the living room and get to know their names and see what they're watching. It's sort of the same idea that through monitoring, we can spot check. And then that's an opportunity, not just for endless lectures, not just to confiscate the phone, but to have a conversation. You know, where were you? And give me more context. Can you tell me more? You know, I saw this and I was concerned, but I want to hear, like, talk to me more about what was going on. If we start with a conversation, we tend to get more information and we might be missing some context. That doesn't mean there's no room for taking the phone away as a consequence, if that's part of the consequence. But if we start with a conversation, we're much more likely to get to that learning, which is what we want, right? How do we learn from this? How do we move forward? And then how do we partner with the school if necessary, right? Mm-hmm. If we're concerned about our student safety, if we're concerned, maybe we're getting information from our kid about some of their friends, right? Mm-hmm. And I think when parents can approach it as a partnership, I think we all want what's best for kids. When I see it most successful, and I'll be curious what you two think, is when parents can come in with their concerns. We all assume we're on the same page that we want what's best for kids. What role can I play at home? What role can you play at school? And how can we... you know, trust that the school's going to partner with us on that. There's some things as parents we can't even know, and we have to, you know, mm-hmm. we have to just go with our clear concerns and whatever evidence we have. And that doesn't mean that we just say, well, there's nothing we can do, but how do we team? How do we team on this? Because there's going to be students involved that we don't know, and we may not know the full scenario, but we know our kid and we've learned what we can, and we need to, you know, address it from there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love what you said about teaching. So I have a 2 and a 5-year-old, so I take mad notes from the parents I work with and my colleagues on how we're going to manage the social media world. And, you know, the parents and the students that I see are the most successful are the ones who take that approach, and it's a gradual release. So some parents have even gone to the extent of writing a little technology contract with their students, which might sound uber structured, but I think it's really neat in that there's very clear expectations mm-hmm. and clear consequences as far as, you know, if you don't act in alignment with our family values, you'll have a week break with from your phone or something like that. So there are no surprises. And I think I have come to think of social media similar to, you know, guidance that is given to parents as far as TV, in that you choose the appropriate platforms, the appropriate apps, but also to watch TV or engage in social media with your child so that you do see some of the ugly things that are happening and you can say, yep, this is a reality, and how are we going to navigate this? How are we going to work through this together? I think we miss a lot of real rich teaching opportunities and learning opportunities for ourselves as adults if we just put our head in the sand, like you said. So I think we do need to lean in and be okay with the discomfort of not understanding this world, maybe sometimes not understanding all of the apps, but just learning for the sake of our kids. And as far as the partnership between school and home, I completely agree. It's so critical. And I know as a school, we really appreciate it when parents reach out to us and say, hey, here's what I'm seeing. What can you do? And I also do want to acknowledge it is really difficult. And I understand being a parent myself when I have to tell another parent, I really appreciate you giving this report. I'm going to follow up in accordance with our behavior policy. But I apologize, I cannot give you information about that student. I can understand how that would be really difficult as a parent who's worried to hear that. But of course, there's data privacy and other things that we need to be respectful of. But we do follow up and we take social media incidences seriously. And we try to take the same approach where it's teaching. And we're working with students to talk about implications, not only in the community, but in representing our school, representing themselves in the future for job applications, for college applications. You know, it's no news to anyone here that we hear that some colleges hop online and look at a student's digital footprint when they are considering whether they're going to accept or reject someone. And again, although students and we all maybe sometimes feel that we're protected with some anonymity online, it's really not as far as it goes. And so I know I will be coaching my own children, and I talk to my own students about, don't make any assumptions that anything is private. Don't make any assumptions that this won't come back and be connected to you, and have the integrity to act online as you would in person.
I love that. Just as a quick, I love that you brought up the technology agreement or the, you know, the family media agreement, because we do sometimes it's like, oh, that seems so formal, but wow, is it easier to back off? Like mm-hmm. if we start very structured, it's much easier as a parent to loosen over time as our kids earn our trust than it is to try to come back in with a 15-year-old, you know, so
absolutely.
I think in some ways, starting off with those things that maybe almost feel overkill or cheesy, but are about just mm-hmm. setting up communication and expectations. It's also just great exercise for their brain, their mm-hmm. habits. Like, how do I want to use this thing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had some practice.
Yeah, I will tell you the most difficult situations are where a parent feels like they don't have control. And there are a lot of parents out there that feel like, I have, whatever the norms are in our family, I cannot ask my student to, or my child to leave their phone downstairs or on the kitchen table when they go to bed. I feel like I cannot take my student's phone, even though they might have made some mistakes. So that's something I've learned loud and clear in my work with students and with parents that, again, it is really easier, much easier to have more structure at the beginning and then gradually release. And I would also encourage us to think of it as an opportunity to support our students. When you're monitoring and it's just an expectation that you're going to be checking in and out, like you said, you're going to catch some of those difficult things where our students are negatively impacted. And that's our opportunity as mom and dad to support them and to mm-hmm. help them through those difficult times. So our students really need us. And it's very similar, again, to your playground analogy where you wouldn't let a two-year-old go to the playground by themselves. You would provide those boundaries, the gradual release, be there to catch them if they fall, and our students still need our support in that regard online as well.
Can I go back to that frustration with, you know, parents, they don't feel like they're in control. With the police department, it's the same at the school. We have data practice laws that we have to follow, and we know parents get frustrated, and I can't reiterate enough that we are investigating them. We just can't share. And there's only limited information, even with our collaborative effort with school resource officers and the school, there's certain information we can't share either. So it is a challenge, but I just want to remind people that when we get these calls, we take them serious, and they are a challenge to investigate. A lot of times we just have a student's first name. So, just go back to data practice. It's a challenge, and there's things that we always tell people they can do first. If they call us, our school resource officers, EMA patrol officer, we have a lot of resources at our, you know, we can share with people too. Just a couple that are more local. The Youth Service Bureau has a bullying awareness mm-hmm. program, and they also have responsible social media classes. And I think people sometimes think they can't do that until their child gets into trouble, and that's be proactive. You can sign up for them. It's geared towards both the students and their parents. It's not just drop your student off and they'll learn all this, but you know, it's a good opportunity for parents and their students to have these conversations.
I think that'd be a great conversation, you know, starter and tool, you know, a good basis for conversation if, you know, parents and students take that class together, you know, and then that's opens up that conversation, just like we were talking about.
And it's better when you're doing it proactively than as a consequence to something too. Mm-hmm. Like you just have a better communication between the parents and their children too.
And we see when young people get involved, some kind of extraordinary things can happen. I mean, mm-hmm. when I'm sitting, I'm sure you have experienced this too. I mean, we share a lot of concerns with our kids. Like when they're actually being honest, they have a lot of the same excitement and concerns about social media. That doesn't mean that they have all the habits and impulse control to enact them, but you know, plugging your kid into campaigns around positive school climate and, you know, getting them involved in a film class so that they can make films about these things, right? It doesn't have to just be turn it off, but can we engage in these things in a way that we're really activating their voice and their desire to sort of switch the culture a bit? And what would it look like to start a campaign around a culture of kindness in a school that's actually student-driven and student-led? Those kinds of things I think are really exciting and help kids practice digital skills at the same time that they're sort of practicing some of those healthier habits too. So if you hear about those things happening in your kid's district or school or out of school time, we just see great benefit from that kind of work.
I agree. Our kids are amazing and they have the power to do really, really great things online and in person. So
yeah,
there's some real benefits as well.
Do you have any other closing comments or any other last, you know, final thoughts to leave with our listeners today?
You know, I would just reiterate, I think, you know, talking early, talking often, using resources like Common Sense Media or other things through the district where we can get, you know, what are the coolest apps lately? And being willing to have conversation starters outside of what we call sort of these critical incidents, right? So we're asking about apps or we're asking about dynamics before we're in the hot water. that between that and then what we talked about last time, which is just doing the hard work at home of setting boundaries mm-hmm. around, you know, some of these things really boil up oftentimes at night, mm-hmm. overnight. So, mm-hmm. you know, we don't need to demonize technology. We can engage in it with them, have conversations with them, and also give them some really important time to rest and give that brain and that impulse control time to recharge so they're not having some of these things erupt around midnight. So getting phones out of the bedroom and mm-hmm. then when they're back in their hands that we can use them for good.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I think as we have tightened up our school policy against cell phones, we've seen a general decrease in anxiety and drama in our students. And I think having a phone accessible at all times is really a risk factor and a stressor for students. It's hard for them to put it down. It's hard for them to say no when there's constant messages and pinging and all of that. And so I do think it's an important boundary to set with students or our children that they don't have access all night. I see students at school who haven't slept hardly at all, and it's typically either from video game use or cell phone use. And so I think that's a really healthy boundary to draw.
I'd say from the police department, if something doesn't feel right, call us. You're never bothering us. I know I have a lot of parents that say, "Well, I don't get this," and neither do some of our officers. But we have access to a lot of resources, and I'd rather the officer kind of look into it, notify the school or whatnot. But if it doesn't feel right to you, don't hesitate to call us. We'll definitely work with parents.
Thank you. Those are some wonderful suggestions moving forward. So as we talked about in this podcast today, we had many, many great measures and strategies that families can take to help their child navigate, you know, through social media successfully, you know, both from, you know, when they're, you know, 2 years old as they observe us on our cell phones to, you know, adults. And so really, I challenge you as a listener today to take advantage of all these great resources and strategies that were shared and really utilize these tips from the experts that we have here on our podcast today. So I just want to thank you again. And just a huge thank you to Pete Kerner, Aaron Walsh, and Sarah Skolnstoics for joining us today and just sharing your wonderful expertise and insight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks
for the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our conversation today. You can learn more about our guests and find tips and resources about managing social media and mental health online at www.sowashco, spelled sowashco.org/livingonline. This podcast was produced by South Washington County Schools thanks to funding from a grant provided by Prairie Care.